This is a podcast from The Times.
The Bugle, audio newspaper for a visual world.
Hello, Buglers, and welcome to the second century of Bugles. That's right, it's Bugle 101. With me, Andy Zaltzman, in the unbelievably British city of London, England, and the city known also as Gotham. After an incident during the War of Independence in 1781, when George Washington got into a fist fight with the British General Lord Cornwallis on the southern tip of Manhattan Island during a dispute about how to spell the word colour, Cornwallis knocked out little George's two front teeth with a real haymaker and when, after a long search, the future inaugural president found his two incisors under a hedge, he said, "Here we are, Gotham."
Oh!
Anyway, in Gotham, or New York, as the locals like to call it, it's Johnny, Kid Potato Oliver!
Hello, Andy! Hello, Buglers! Welcome to Bugle 101. Andy, a quick football update for you. Played again on Tuesday, and at one point we were 4-0 down.
Yeah.
Partly due to the fact that we are playing with very small goals in this league, and also the fact that the opposing team had a freakish giant as their goalkeeper. His big hands catching each ball before squeezing it like a disappointing plum and hurling it away. The game was clearly going to result in a loss, and we were just playing for pride, and that is when John Oliver ran from deep. Not picked up by the girl who was at that point marking him. And a mishit shot came flying through the area. Oliver opened up his body, balletically diverted the ball into the far corner. The giant had no chance of stopping it, merely grumbling something to himself about how he was now going to crush a village somewhere. Oliver wheeled away triumphant and 45 seconds later was nearly booked for over-celebration.
I got sent off in a game of four-a-side football once. I was fouled and I ran after this guy and kicked him in the ankle.
How old were you?
About 15.
Fuck. Hooligan. Now, next week, Andy, there'll be a slightly different bugle because it looks at the moment like I'm going to be over at the Republican winter meeting in Hawaii. So it'll be the furthest we've ever been apart.
All right.
Probably at any point in our life. Actually, that's not true. You were in Australia once when I was in England.
No, you were already in America by then.
So is that further, then?
Well, hang on, let's consult Captain Johnny Internet.
Yeah, you were in Melbourne when I was in New York. Yeah.
Well, the distance between New York and Melbourne, Australia, is 10,355 miles.
So you go, that's it.
And the distance between London and Hawaii is 7,230 miles.
So we've actually been further apart? It's not.
Yeah.
It's a stone's throw.
Well, we got through that, didn't we?
Yeah.
Admittedly, we weren't working together at the time.
We can do it, Andy. We can do it.
So, here we are, Bugle 101. Let's hope it doesn't emulate its number-sake airship, R101, star of the famous 1930 airship crash, the R101 disaster. Other than the fact that John and I will, of course, be absolutely on fire. As always, some sections of the Bugle going straight in the bin, including book reviews. We look at the latest self-help guides out this year, including How to Shout in Public and Find Love, You and Your Eyebrows, Unlocking the Power of the Frown, The Stranger Whisperer, How to Make Friends on Crowded Public Transport by Gently Whispering into People's Ears about Fun Things You Might One Day Do Together, and The Expectant Expectorant, Spitting for a Long Life. Also in the bin, a year-by-year look at human history. This week, we look at all the big events, cultural landmarks and latest fashions that hit the world in 34,020 BC, with a special feature on how to make a jockstrap out of an animal.
Top story this week, how to lose hope and irritate people. Andy, this time last year, I was in Washington, D.C., freezing my nuts off, witnessing Barack Obama become President Barack Obama, and watching a crowd go crazy before realising how cold they were and attempting to leave. And 12 months later, we seem to be experiencing a similar thing on a bigger scale. That warm feeling in the stomach we had 12 months ago of hope and change has been replaced by a stabbing pain in the chest that then shoots down our side. This last week, Massachusetts, the gay-marrying, lobster-eating, Jeter-hating, high-taxing, healthcare-providing, green monster-loving and Kennedy-spawning epicentre of liberalism, elected a Republican to the Senate. And if you're Obama, Andy, and I know that you're the first to admit you're not, it's impossible to interpret this as anything other than a slap to the face, a kick to the balls, and an entirely unnecessary tweak to the left nipple. This would be a bad situation in the best of times, but unfortunately we are at the other end of that Dickens novel starter. This seat just happened to be the Democrats' 60th seat and represented a supermajority which was the only hope of passing a healthcare bill which, though flawed, would have covered an extra 31 million Americans and eliminated the insurance company loopholes for pre-existing conditions. Meanwhile, Massachusetts happens to already have great health insurance, so there was absolutely no incentive for them to vote for someone they didn't like in order to get the bill through. Oh, and one more thing, the seat only became free because Ted Kennedy, one of the greatest campaigners for healthcare, had just died. You know what, Andy? It would be funny if a series of funny things had happened rather than a series of things that were hugely frustrating and heartbreakingly disappointing.
I guess what we and the rest of the world forget, because, of course, the rest of the world overwhelmingly voted for Obama in the election.
They did.
In 2008, albeit that those votes weren't actually counted. We forget that in the grand scheme of things, there wasn't that much in it, and actually two-thirds of US voters didn't vote for him, if you include the people who didn't vote for anyone. There's a lot of debate over whether Obama has failed so far. Now, to my admittedly non-American eyes, he seems to have done all right, but then I don't have news channels telling me that he's totally ruined what was a perfectly good country 12 months ago. But I think the more interesting question is this, John. Is it possible for any politician to succeed nowadays, or at least to be considered to be succeeding, in this world of 24-hour news, dementedly partisan politics, an economy dependent on needing people to think they need and deserve more than they're currently getting, and like Rush Limbaugh smearing Tabasco into the eyes of hope, a world of delusional perception, frantic opinion twisting and general political screaming? And more than that, is it even possible for people to be happy with their and their nation's lot in such a world when they are constantly being told that they shouldn't be, cannot be under the current administration and aren't? Now, I don't know, John. I'm only 35 and I spend most of my time thinking about sport. So,
true.
Don't ask me.
If you want the future of politics, Andy, why not look to the Republican who spectacularly won that Massachusetts Senate seat? His name is Scott Brown, and he campaigned on a platform of having a truck, saying no to things, and having a pair of attractive daughters, one of whom did quite well on American Idol a few years ago. Apparently, that's enough to derail healthcare. Plus the fact that 28 years ago, and this is true, Andy, he did a naked centrefold for Cosmo, wang out. I think it might be the case that people just inherently trust politicians who are willing to get their bits out. It's a trust issue. Maybe they've got a swastika tattooed on their arse cheek. Maybe they haven't. The point is, the electorate deserve to know who they're electing and what they're packing, both downtown and uptown.
And what was he packing, John?
It's hard to say. The staples are in the way.
That's always your excuse.
So how have the Democrats reacted to this Massachusetts humbling, Andy? They're probably either fighting back or whining. Please let it be the first one. Please let it be the first one. Please let it... Oh, shit. A talking point was leaked just yesterday from a new internal Senate Democratic memo, which says, Republicans have an obligation to the American people to join us in governing our nation through these difficult times and to help clean up the mess they left behind. It's mathematically impossible for Democrats to pass legislation on our own. Senate Republicans must come to the table with ideas for improving our nation and not obstructionist tactics. Hold on. Hold on. It is mathematically impossible for Democrats to pass legislation now, with an 18-seat majority. Is it just me, Andy? Or does that seem entirely mathematically possible? I've never said my math was good. I'm not great with numbers, but I'm good enough to know what numbers are bigger than other numbers. How is it the Democrats find it so hard to get things done? Even with their 60-seat supermajority, they struggle to pass legislation. I think it may be time for them to get some assertiveness training, because Bush and Cheney were very, very good at getting things through, and they had significantly less seats to do it with. They simply had the ability, and perhaps more importantly, the willingness, to look opponents in the eye and say, you, I'm doing it anyway. So here are a series of helpful phrases that I think the Democrats could do with learning for their newfound assertiveness. Are you thirsty? How about a cool glass of shut-up juice? Hands up here, who is the president? Everyone put their f***ing hands down apart from me. And finally, I'm sorry you don't agree with our healthcare platform, and I'm even sorrier that your mother's sexually transmitted diseases will now go untreated. Boom!
What did you say? Your mathematical capabilities aren't great, John, as evidenced by the fact that you seem to think that there is only one math, whereas, of course, it is, in fact, maths.
Yes.
Maths, John.
You're right. You're right. I stand corrected.
You're losing touch with your roots. I guess we should remember in mitigation that when Obama sat down in the Oval Office for the first time a year ago, he faced a British National Party leader, Nick Griffin, of an intray. Massive, hideous, profoundly disturbing and totally immovable. And blaming Obama for many of the troubles that he's faced is a bit like blaming the vet who is currently trying to recover your TV remote control from your dog's esophagus for the fact that you shoved your TV remote control down your dog's esophagus just to see what would happen. But I guess the thing is, John, it seems to me that much of America is still struggling to take to its heart a president who is A, black as night, B, born in Kenya, probably in some kind of satanic ritual, C, an Islamic fundamentalist who cannot be trusted on aeroplanes, and D, basically Lenin.
Yep, he's all those things. But before we despair, let's look on the plus side and remember, it could have been so different and so, so much worse. Not the McCain-Palin national suicide ticket, not that. No, instead, right now, we could feasibly have been 12 months into a John Edwards presidency, a presidency which would be collapsing around his ears in scandal. Now, you may remember that John Edwards admitted to having an affair during the campaign at the same time that his wife was being treated for terminal cancer. So we already knew this guy was pure class. But at the time, he fiercely denied that he'd fathered a love child with his mistress. Well, on Thursday, Edwards released a depressingly unsurprising statement at breakfast time, a statement that made a nation's cereal milk curdle in their mouths. Here it is, and you may want to have a bottle of Purell handy to shoot in your ears once you've heard this. The statement read, "I am Quinn's father. It was wrong for me to ever deny she was my daughter, and hopefully one day, when she understands, she will forgive me." Well, let's see about that, shall we, John Edwards? Because that's going to be a very awkward conversation for you to have with your young daughter one day. Oh, hello, Quinn. Just before I tuck you in, there's something I need to talk to you about. Sometimes, when a man loves himself very, very much, he's willing to prostitute everything and everyone around him for narcissistic political gain. OK, sweet dreams. Who loves you? That's right, your mommy loves you. I, personally, I like you. Don't get me wrong. I like you fine, I just prefer myself, given the choice. Night! He's a turbo douche, Andy.
But I think one day, as he wishes, she will understand and forgive him. Because, you know, when she understands a bit more about American politics, John, and the pressures of running for president, the most powerful job in the world, she'll realise that her daddy, John Edwards, needed all the help he could get to beat two vastly superior candidates. And John Edwards had clearly read his Greek mythology, and he knows that to gain divine favour for a successful campaign, you have to sacrifice your own daughter, Agamemnon style. Now, of course, as you said, Edwards' wife was battling cancer at the time, so in the circumstances, it would have been rude to use one of her existing daughters, and right, she presumably wasn't really up for having another one at the time. So the best thing for everyone was for him to sire another daughter with a random mistress specifically for sacrifice. In fact, he did it for the good of his wife and his family. And when she's a bit older and not so preoccupied with throwing things on the floor and trying to eat everything she picks up like the one-year-old she is, she'll understand that, John.
John Edwards, terrible modern politician, outstanding ancient Greek.
He's denied pretty much everything at various points, hasn't he? From the affair to the child to his possession of a penis and testicles. In fact, at one point he denied ever having eaten breakfast, claimed that he has never used a pen, and declared that muddy waters didn't exist.
The National Enquirer, who broke the story, are submitting their John Edwards coverage to the Pulitzer Committee. John Edwards is so bad that he's managed to make a publication, a viable candidate for the Pulitzer, which has stories about people getting anally probed by aliens and headlines such as, "I boiled my baby and ate it."
Yeah, but they nicked that off the Daily Telegraph. Decline of the British nation news now, and British chocolate manufacturer and confectioner Cadbury's is mulling over an aggressive takeover bid from the American food, snack, drink conglomerate Kraft. And this has been big news here, John. There's been much gnashing of teeth about the flogging off of British heritage and our general national decline. Some people blaming the government for not stepping in, which legally they couldn't possibly have done. But it's still their fault. We have to ask, John, What would it mean to Britain if Cadbury, the most iconic of all British chocolate makers, a company that was founded in 1824, that was Queen Victoria's personal chocolate pimp, and whose owner and big philanthropy fan, George Cadbury, in the late 19th century, built a model village to give his workers good, cheap accommodation? What would it mean if this company was to be taken over by a massive US conglomerate most famous for making barely edible cheese? It's a blow to this nation's solar plexus, yeah. John.
Oh, no, another British icon has fallen. Sound the last post. We're under attack from the Americans, Andy. We're running out of things to defend. And this, I'll say this right now, will not stand. First, they came for our tea, and I was not yet born, so I did not speak up. Then they came for Manchester United, but I was not a Manchester United fan, so I did not speak up. Then they came for our mid to low range confectionery, and I lost my shit. That's it, Andy. I'm stitching an elaborate red coat. I'm polishing my musket. I'll meet you on Virginia Beach. They've pushed us too far. We are taking America back.
That is, those are passionate words from someone who just used the word math.
Yeah, you're right. And they ring hollow after that wholly regrettable slip-up.
A linguistic abomination, I think.
You're right, you mentioned that Cadbury's has been in business since 1824, which was just 40 years after American independence. It was actually created because we were so depressed about losing the War of Independence, and we just wanted to binge out on chocolate and burn all the maps of America that we had to get rid of all those painful memories. To quote Pat Robertson, true story.
Well, Cadbury's is Britain's last remaining domestically owned mega confectioner. Right. And our national heritage of producing products that ravage the nation's dental health is in serious jeopardy here.
Yeah.
And now it seems that our teeth are going to be ruined by overseas company. It hardly seems worth ruining them at all. Sorry, I'll just say that again. Yeah. Now that our teeth are going to be ruined by overseas companies, it hardly seems worth us ruining them at all. I mean, we might as well have just let the Nazis feed us sherbet until our mouths fell out. But what does it mean for Britain as a nation, John? This year, as you say, yet another plank of British culture being sold off. Are we now basically Luxembourg without the standard of living? Or does it, on the other hand, show that we've actually moved on from childish things such as chocolate and philanthropy to real 21st century concerns such as the derivatives industry, binge drinking and social breakdown? And I think that makes us much more grown up as a nation.
Kraft said the deal would create a global confectionery leader. And the world of confectionery needs that, Andy. They've been leaderless for too long. They need someone to help focus them on doing what they do best, making more confectionery.
That's right. Yeah, they've lacked a leader really ever since Willy Wonka went down for dubious workplace practices.
That is the problem. He was the Trotsky of chocolate. Now, Kraft also said there's a real concern about jobs for Cadbury employees, and Kraft said that it expected, and I quote, meaningful cost savings as a result of the merger, which sounds chillingly sterile. That has to be bad news for Cadbury employees. It's like someone promising you meaningful weight loss before starting to cut off your limbs.
The problem is, John, that this has come down to the Cadbury shareholders, and owning shares in Britain carries absolutely no responsibility at all. And Cadbury's itself sold itself basically 40 years ago when it merged with Schweppes to attempt the still unachieved goal of fizzy chocolate. But it now means that a quarter of Cadbury shares are owned by hedge funds who are basically casino sharks who couldn't give a flying about job cuts and the social decline associated with the kind of cost efficiencies that accompany such deals. As we all know, John, gambling ruins lives. It's just, in this kind of gambling, the lives it ruins are not its own.
War update now. And a UN report revealed that Afghan people paid out $2.5 billion in bribes over the last 12 months, which is the equivalent of almost one quarter of the country's legitimate GDP. And for start, I do like that phrase, legitimate GDP. And it's like cab drivers. You know they make a lot more than they let on for tax purposes. And Afghanistan's legitimate GDP is essentially their actual GDP minus heroin. That is the official equation for their incomings.
Antonio Maria Costa, who is the head of the UN Office on Drugs and Crime, or UNODC, to give it its catchy acronym. He said, the Afghans say it's impossible to obtain a public service without paying a bribe. Bribery is a crippling tax on people who are already among the world's poorest. So it basically is tax, and surely it's a much more efficient form of taxation, John, bribery, because there you're paying at the point of delivery as and when you require the service, not just lumping your hard-earned wedgies or wedge into a nebulous government trouser pocket. So I think we would actually probably welcome that in this country. I think it's a much more upfront and honest way of paying tax.
You say that, Andy, but this survey asked 7,600 people and found that nearly 60% of them were more concerned about corruption than they were concerned about security or unemployment. So they're more concerned about corruption than they are about their own safety, which is really saying something considering how safe they are. You've got to be really annoyed with something for it to annoy you more than things exploding all around you. Only 9% of the urban population also have ever reported an act of corruption to the authorities. That's presumably because you'd have to bribe those authorities to accept the complaint. So you really don't want to start chasing your losses and doubling down.
Most of the bribes apparently are paid to police, judges and politicians. You know, Afghanistan is, I guess, you know, emerging from the wreckage. In some ways, it's a very, very young nation and still endearingly naive. They still call it bribery and not, as we do over here, lobbying.
In other war news, a Michigan company has been covertly inscribing coded references to New Testament Bible passages about Jesus Christ on high-powered rifle sights provided to the US military. Oh, boy. The sights are used not only by US soldiers in Iraq and Afghanistan, but also in the training of Iraqi and Afghan soldiers, most of whom are Muslim. The company involved, Trigicon, I think they're called, has a $660 million contract with the US government. This story is like a part-boiled blowfish. Nothing about it looks good. Let's give Trigicon the benefit of the doubt here. Maybe this was actually part of the order. Maybe the order form from the US military said, please also put something on the site which, once discovered, will jeopardise the safety and effectiveness of the missions our troops are fighting. We'll leave the details of that up to you. Surprise us.
Apparently, this could contravene US regulations on proselytising your religion while on military service, I believe. And you have to ask, though, is it proselytising? Because you would have to get pretty close to those small letters on the sights of a gun to be at any significant risk of being proselytised. And I think it must be confusing for the soldiers, John, who are sitting there looking at these letters, trying to work out exactly what passage of the Bible is helping them deliver injury and death upon their foe. John 8:12. Now, hang on, is that the bit about doing unto others who's have them do unto you, missus? Or is it the bit about how God loves everyone? Well, let's see. Bang! I didn't really like either the way that one came out.
It's not so much that it's proselytising as it just looks bad. Remember that story of the snipers using the Quran for target practice? Well, it turned out that they may have been shooting the Quran with guns that had Bible passages inscribed on them. That is the perfect crusade metaphor. In fact, it's not even subtle enough to be a metaphor. It just is what it is. Now, Tom Munson, the director of sales and marketing for Trigicon, said the inscriptions are, quote, have always been there, and said there was nothing wrong or illegal with adding them. He also said that all these concerns were being raised by a group that is not Christian. F*** you. Really? Nothing wrong with it, Tom. No potential consequences to that. I'm guessing that a director of sales and marketing in Michigan has never found his chicken shit ass in a situation where he'd be using one of the products his company makes. So he's in no way qualified to make that f***ing comment.
Also, you have to ask, how Christian can a company that makes $660 million out of selling weapons be?
Well, extremely Christian, Andy. Their website says, we believe that America is great when its people are good. This goodness has been based on biblical standards throughout our history and we'll strive to follow those morals. No, that is not what America is based on. That is the opposite. For a company that claims to love America so much, its practices are pretty explicitly unconstitutional and are essentially meaning that soldiers are forced to and are inadvertently shooting Muslims with Jesus rifles. Why stop there, Trigicon? Why not paint crucifixes onto the side of bombs or invent bunker-busting Bible bazookas, which fire the good book over a range of 3 miles? Maybe this company thought that American troops just didn't have a hard enough job to do. Maybe they thought they needed to do something to spice up what was happening 7,000 miles away from their comfortable offices. Feature section now, and adult feature.
If you are not an adult, you may not listen to this section unless you want to.
And the government officials in South Korea are being given an odd encouragement to go home and, I don't know how to put this, but get it on! South Korea's Ministry of Health has announced that one Wednesday per month, they will turn off the office lights at 7 p.m. all across the office to encourage employees to go home and procreate or get it on! The problem is that South Korea has one of the lowest birth rates in the world. And a British journalist spoke to a government official, two repressed men, trying to talk around what they actually needed to talk about, and asked him whether he would be taking advantage of the time to spend some private moments with his wife. The official blushed, pointed out that he wasn't actually married, that he'd actually be spending the extra time with his parents. Ouch. Those are going to be some extra private moments with himself then, Andy. Mom, don't come in yet! I'm in the shower! Shut the door! Shut the door!
Apparently, John, the greater factor dissuading young Koreans from firing out babies left, right and centre, although they do mostly come out centre from my experience, are the staggering cost of childcare, the lack of job protection for mothers, the inadequate public education and massively expensive private education, the hump-stiflingly long working hours, and the rumour going around that if you have a baby, A, it's really painful, and B, when you force it out, it spends most of its time puking, pissing, crapping and crying. But will this scheme work, John, or will the Korean work ethic mean that employees merely turn up to work with torches strapped to their heads so that they can carry on after the lights have gone out? Or will they go home and not thraggle each other but play computer games or something, or write poems? Who knows? Not me, John. All I really know about South Korea is that they got some extremely dubious favourable refereeing decisions in their favour when hosting the 2002 Football World Cup.
Let it go, Andy. Let it go.
I just think it could have been Spain's year.
It's off topic, Andy. It's off topic. Apparently, they're also offering gift cards to parents who have multiple children. And come on, nothing gets you in the mood better than the offer of a gift card, Andy. I've always said, when the gift cards come out, the clothes come off.
Can be difficult, obviously, conceiving a child. But speaking as someone who's personally added two to the world's population, which puts me level overall...
Where's your gift card? Where's your South Korean gift card?
But I've added two, so that puts me level overall after those two. Never mind. As a father of two, here are my top tips for successful conception.
Oh, God. Let me just go and cut my ears off the side of my head.
Number one, sacrifice many cattle to the ancient Hungarian fertility god Todge, originator of the term todger. Two, ensure that the female is wearing a fertility cloak made of purest polyester, preferably the very finest harvest from the far-famed polyestrica groves of southern Italy. Three, to prepare the male for maximum fertilisatory power, it's advisable that for the 18 months prior to intended conception, he eats nothing but tadpoles, the creature from nature which most closely resembles the male Spremulus, and that he should exercise by swimming through dark, narrow, inhospitable tubes. A man should not expect his spremuli to do anything that he is not prepared to do himself. Four, to ensure that the female egg cracks open at just the right time to allow entry to the spremulus, place a pair of high-calibre headphones onto the female stomach and play the classic 1959 Paul Anka hit, Let's Make a Zygote, brackets, with our gametes, a graphically biological number that received scant airplay at the time, although a later cover version by ABBA was a big hit, released with a new tune and new lyrics under the name Fernando. Five, to ensure that the fertilised gametus successfully completes its mission to womb central, fit it with a homing device, like GPS or a pigeon. And six, to maximise your embryoid's chances of folgerising into a fully-fledged foetata, inject the female womb daily with strong cider. The appley taste will give the nascent cells a sense that external life is worth striving for, and the alcohol will render it insensible to the tedium of life in the womb. A litre or 1.5 pints should be sufficient for the daily injection, unless you have an unusually thirsty foetata. And finally, seven, when it comes to the actual birth, make sure you get to hospital on time, because if it plops out in your bedroom like mine did, it makes a real f***ing mess of the floor. Other adult news now, and a school in Wisconsin has banned any mention of Europe in its classes. School principal McNeil Pachanik explained, "I've just had the misfortune to accidentally go to an exhibition of ancient Greek vases with my elderly mother. These people were animals! On the evidence of these vases, it seems there was absolutely nothing they wouldn't stick it in. They're supposed to be the forefathers of European civilization, and yet they drew pictures like these? On vases? Household objects like vases? What next? Pornographic flower pots? Is nothing sacred. So anything from Europe is out, I'm afraid, here in Wisconsin. Wisconsin. If they couldn't behave on vases, heaven only knows what subliminal messages are lurking in shit like Homer's Iliad. It's probably the script of Debbie Does Dallas if you read it backwards. That continent has got a lot to answer for. Filthy little bastards. Pachanik, whose 86-year-old mother is still recovering in hospital, having never seen a willy before, did, however, accept the apologies of the exhibition curators, the Wisconsin Museum of Erotic Art, and received free tickets for their forthcoming show, Mosaics from Pompeii. That should be great, he says. My mum loves mosaics.
Your emails now, and, well, Andy, we've had a short but spectacular email from Johan Strandberg, who wrote, "Sirs, as an explanation for your note of an earthquake deficit during the Nazi rule of Germany, you are confusing tectonics with teutonics." Boom.
Or not boom.
Not boom, yeah.
Not or boom different kind all. Of booms.
Well done, Johan. That is, it's a sparse email, but boy, oh boy, that comes in with a big pun.
And well done also, Johan Strandberg, for having a name that sounds like you might have been a little-known late 19th century composer. This email, which I think can double as the sports section for this week, comes in from Joshua Norman in New Orleans, La. Oh, La, he's happy. That's good. It's good that people are happy after everything there. "Dear Andy and John, I'm a long-time fan of the show, probably one of the lone outposts of such here in the American South. Your brand of socialist American-hating humour would probably get you tarred and feathered by most people I know. Anyway, to get to my point..." It's good to know these things. "A UK company has not only produced a stab-proof vest marketed for soccer hands headed to the World Cup in South Africa this summer, but you can have your home team's flag plastered on the front."
Oh, no.
"Now, I ask the philosophical conundrum this presents. Doesn't having a stab-proof vest with an American, or more probably a British flag on the front, make you more likely to get stabbed, therefore balancing out the net benefit of having a stab-proof vest in the first place?"
I mean, I suppose if you're going to get a stab-proof vest, you want to use it. They're probably not cheap.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's like a bumper on your car, isn't it? Or an airbag.
Is it, Andy? Remind me never to get in a car with you again.
"This brings me to my second question. Which flag is most likely to get you stabbed? I say the British flag, followed in order by the American, French and Italian flags. I mean, who likes Italians besides Italians? Seriously, if they couldn't cook, they'd be ranked with the Estonians in terms of world importance." No offence to Estonia intended, but I'm sure some taken, if anyone is listening in Estonia. If you are an Italian football hooligan and you are causing trouble, you can always just pacify situation by lobbing a mozzarella into the mellow.
An English fan's response would be to shout, "Ingerland, Ingerland, Ingerland," yep, and then throw a brick at you. So yeah.
They probably will.
You're Scottish. What generally happens when Scottish fans...
"Ingerland, Ingerland."
Scottish fans, they turn up at Wembley and they snap the crossbar, don't they, Tom?
You had it coming.
6 months off the tournament and already a bit of verbals going back and forth.
I think it might actually have been the very crossbar that's... Jeff Hurst hit with the third goal of the 1966 World Cup final, which put England 3-2 up against Germany, which was, of course, the worst moment in Scottish football history.
Just a note for our American listeners, give it 2 minutes while we sort this out. Listen, after so many years being the engine room of empire, and then we're not thanked, we're just basically given unemployment by Margaret Thatcher, it was a great moment in Scottish history, beating you people at Wembley.
Andy, now, I course, don't speak Scottish. What did he just say?
American listeners, come back in. I'm with you during the World Cup precisely because of this attitude. England are the most arrogant, the worst football team in any major tournament. In South Africa, there will be trouble. England fans will be at the centre of it.
So speaks a proud Scot. How long have you been living in London again? How long is it?
I'm about to leave.
Yeah. Where to? Back home to Scotland?
Even
to be in the bosom
away.
Of your own people?
The Scottish province of Australia.
Even further away from Scotland. You couldn't be further away without starting to head towards the moon. No one's blaming you, Tom.
Where are you, John?
I'm fair
Luton.
Distance from
Is
Scotland.
That Luton? No, you're Bedford, that's right. Like you, John, I came here for the jobs.
John is very close to New England.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're both economic migrants and you make me sick.
Another email here from Seth Purcell. Includes his email and phone number. Just, I would not do that on an email. I wouldn't do that. Dear Andy, John and Tom, he says, given the Bugle's kiss of death to relationships, something proven several times over, that is depressingly true, I want to submit my plea for the Bugle to once again work its magic. Please mention the long-standing marriage between Pat Robertson and hatred, bigotry and ignorance, the nefarious three-headed hydra from across the real River Styx. A previous request from a fellow Bugler for Pat Robertson to shut up was a good start. But with Robertson's comments in the wake of the Haiti disaster, it's clear that this move is simply not enough. Thank you, Seth. It's a good point. Let's see if the Bugle can do what everyone needs it to do at this point and separate the committed marriage between these two bedfellows.
I think that's going to be hard. I'm not sure even the Bugle has the power to do that.
We'll see. Let's give it a best
shot. I'm not sure that it's so much a marriage as being Siamese twins. Now, we've had a competition for the best suggestions for how to celebrate the Bugle 100th, which we were going to do last week, but ended up battering on for so long that we didn't get round to it. And the winner is this entry from Bradley Marchant on the subject 100 Bugles, 27 months and 27 suggestions. To commemorate the 27 months that we've been in existence, he has given us 27 suggestions to commemorate the 100th podcast. I won't give you all 27, we can stick them on the blog. But here are our selection. Number one, start a 100-year war with a country that almost 100% of the world has never heard of. Any suggestions? France. Two, build a building the size of the Burj Khalifa, but making it 100 times more stupid. Well, that is some challenge, by making it mainly from chocolate. That's not going to work in the heat of the Gulf. Number five, tabulate the top 100 Andy Zaltzman lies, with number one being the most unbelievable. It's all right, I've already done that. Oh, there's another one. Number eight, for every time Obama has said, yes, we can, shout at 100 decibels or more, apparently you cannot. Number 10, offer a 100-day tax rebate for all Bugle listeners. Happy to do that. You are all exempt from paying us your tax for the next 100 days. Number 15, start the Buglist faith, and within 100 years aim for it to be the biggest world religion. Deities include Zaltzman, god of misleading facts. That's how I insist that my wife addresses me. Oliver, god of bullshit. I don't know, sub-god, maybe. And Tom, the ruler of the underworld. I'm not sure that's a compliment, Tom.
I'm still angry at you. I'm not talking to you.
16. Andy must write a joke containing no fewer and no more than 100 puns. I don't need to write it. I just talk it. Comes out. 21. Paint a 100-foot penis on the Times headquarters roof. Done. That done before we even started working for them. Congratulations, Bradley Marchant. You have won a T-shirt.
It is a limited edition, i.e. that's the last one.
The last one.
Yeah. Which has...
Maybe we should make some more.
Yeah, maybe we should. Which has either Zaltzman or Oliver, I can't recall,
right,
on the back. So it will be signed and sent off to you.
Wow, nice. So,
yeah, we'll be in touch. Well,
it's probably worth £10 unsigned and £8 signed. So thanks very much for your emails. Do keep them flooding in to thebugle@timesonline.co.uk and do check out my latest blog, written by Tom. No time for sport this week, but next week we will have a feature on American cricket. There, that's got you all listening, hypothetically, in the future. Just have time for the Bugle forecast. This week it's the clothing forecast, and this week is going to be a good week for trousers, an excellent week for underpants, which will be worn in some form by at least 60% of the world's population, according to the UN, and a terrible week for the ruff. Still no signs that it's ever going to return to its 16th century dominance of the neckwear market. So that's it, Buglers. Anything else to say, John?
Well, I'm off to Miami, Andy, to do a gig tomorrow. So in terms of clothes, I'm going to be breaking out my white trousers and my rollerblades.
You're off to Miami. I'm off to my auntie. Hey. I'm not. We don't speak anymore. Not since she buried my grandmother without
telling anyone. Gloss over it. Anyway. Gloss over it, Andy. Now's neither the time nor the place. Have a lovely week, Buglers. I'll speak to you from Hawaii.
Bye.
Bye.
For the best in sport, comedy, science and books, go to timesonline.co.uk/podcasts.